local UFCW 3000. We are the Union. The Union is us. Welcome to our local UFCW 3000 podcast. I have Kathy McPhail with me. She is a bargainer. We are going to go over all of the details of bargaining and how it works today. I do apologize to my listeners if you hear an extra bit of echoing going on in today's recording. It is because we have the biggest conference room in our Seattle building that we are recording in today. So you're going to hear a little extra background noise, but I'll do my best to edit that out for you. Kathy, whenever you're ready, would you like to introduce yourself to our listeners and just tell us who you are and kind of a brief explanation of how you got involved with the union, how long you've been working for the union, and some of the different roles that you've done?
Sure. Yeah. And that might be more than brief because...
And that's okay.
So I'm Kathy, and I think I'm the only Kathy here now at UFCW. At one time we had three, but I have been here since 2003. So I'm at my 20 years with UFCW. I started with UFCW 1105, which was technically a grocery union. And we merged in 2005 with UFCW 1001, which was more of a healthcare and some retail union. We've had several mergers. I can't remember exactly how many since then. So we have changed our local number a few times, and now we're local 3000. Like I said, I started out as a retail rep in 2003. And then when we merged in 2005, I continued to be a retail rep until 2007. And then I moved into healthcare, which was great. Loved healthcare. And I have worked in healthcare ever since. So from 2007 until a couple of years ago, I was mostly a rep. And I can tell you more about that. I don't know how much you want to know about that. And then in 2019, 20, somewhere during the COVID years,
yeah,
I became a negotiator. And I had been at dozens of bargaining tables prior to that, working with the bargainer, and assumed the role of the actual negotiator a couple of years ago, full time, which I love doing.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And quite a bit of history there. So with the three other Kathys, were you the OG Kathy? Are you the OG Kathy, or were there two other Kathys when you started?
Well, there were, I don't think anyone's ever asked me that.
It's a bit of a random question if you're the original.
I'm trying to think. I may have been the only Kathy for a short time. And then there was another Kathy. We all spelled our names just slightly differently.
Yeah.
So I was the C Kathy, and I've been known at UFCW forever as Kathy Mack.
So what I wanted to do in this session with you is kind of cover some of the basics. I ask this question to everyone that I interview of what it's like being a union rep. The reason why I ask that is because I really want to shed some light on how much work you guys do and how much you juggle. As a union member, I know I myself really underestimated how much work you guys do and just how large your workload is. And asking this question to everyone is a nice way of where you don't necessarily have to cover every single aspect, but just the ones that really stick out to you so that collectively, as our listeners listen to this, they can get a better understanding of just how much you guys do.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I know you and I have talked several times about the kind of work that we do. And I think the more that we've talked, the more you find out, and you found out a whole bunch more than that. But essentially, we work to represent the members of the union. And then it kind of like splits off into the so much more area.
Yes.
So we represent members. And what does that mean? It means that we are the people who work with you to make sure that the contract is enforced, and also to make sure that your employer is respecting the contract as it applies to you. So as a union member, you have this contract, which, you know, anyone who's ever read the contract, it's like, it's not something you want to just pick up and read because you want a good read. It's really kind of dry material, right?
It is. It's very tedious, very detailed.
It is. And I've been asked several times, why do we have all this sort of legalese in the contract? Can't we simplify it? Can't we make it a little bit easier to read, or maybe a little bit more entertaining? I don't know. Or that's what people are looking for.
I think they're just looking for more layman terms, because if you sit down and actually go through it, they are right. It's very legal, understandably, because it is a binding contract that right. is set in place by a bargaining team and lawyers. But it's a little difficult to understand, because sometimes when you read the sentence and you think it sounds clear as day what its intent is, it's actually what's between the lines. What does it imply?
Right.
And something as simple as maybe or can, I think the word can is one of the biggest playable words, because you can use that to your advantage, or the employer can use that one word to their advantage, and it can change the whole meaning of just that one sentence. So I think everyone's just looking for more layman terms, you know, break it down to us. It would be kind of interesting if someone took each contract and paragraph by paragraph went through and said, you know what, this is what that means. In two or three sentences.
And, you know, we can do that. I mean, that's what you're asking what reps do. That's one of the things that we do, is try and help people understand what the contract means. It's interesting that you're talking about the words in the contract. As a negotiator, you find out a whole lot more about the difference between, you know, if you phrase things certain ways, or if you use will versus shall. And and the enforcement of the contract is dependent on those words. So, but I agree with you. I think that, you know, we need to be having a bigger dialogue with people who have questions about the contract and understanding it line by line. I don't think they'd want to go through the whole thing with us, not all at one time. It might take a long time and they may get really bored. But, you know, there are pieces of it that are really, really interesting and fascinating and do dictate not just for the employee, but for the employer, what they need to do to make sure that we are enforcing a usable, you know, something that people can access every day in their everyday life. And it dictates what their working conditions will be.
Oh, so, exactly.
Yeah.
I just think that is something definitely interesting to recover. And that just leads us right into the heart of this episode. I really want to get into bargaining. I want to explain it to our listeners. Not too long ago, I had a friend come up to me and ask me about bargaining and how it works and how you get on a bargaining team. And they're great questions. And we sat down and had a really good in-depth conversation. But as more people were entering the room and joining in on this conversation, it really showed me how little our members understand of bargaining, which I was also in that boat as well until I joined a bargaining team. And that's because I don't
remember that. I remember when you joined the bargaining
team. Yeah.
Yeah.
You and John Mary.
I recruited you to join the bargaining team.
Yes, you did recruit me to join it. And it changed a lot for me and really gave me an education on how this system works. And that's what I want to share with our listeners. I want to go over how you get on the bargaining team. And let's just start from the beginning and take our time. And if we run out of time today, we can
we'll
always
have another
pick back
episode.
Up later. Yes.
We'll have chapter two. You know, I think that that's a really good question. We typically look at bargaining teams and try and pull from our really active members, people who are really actively involved in the union, who understand the contract. And that's not necessarily someone who's been involved for a long period of time. It could be someone who has recently joined the union, but they're really interested in the contract, or they really want to see change happen, or they really want to see something different in the contract. So when we're looking at bargaining teams, and I do this all the time, every week, it seems that we're picking a new bargaining team for a different unit that is going into contract negotiations. So we have to look at their knowledge of the contract, their interest in being knowledgeable about the contract. That's important. I think having someone who has been involved, who's been to Weingarten meetings. I'm not sure if you've talked about Weingarten meetings.
We have.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who has been to Weingarten meetings, who understands the idea behind them and representation, and how as a union, you know, we're all in this together. We're all in this together. And so when we pull together a bargaining team, that group is not going to just come to the table and represent the people in their department, but everybody in the bargaining unit. So, you know, in a perfect world, if you have 1,000 people who we're bargaining a contract for, we'd have all 1,000 people at the table. But that's not practical. We have to have a representation of that bargaining unit that fairly represents everybody. But when you come to the bargaining table, as you know, because you've been in bargaining, you represent not just the people in respiratory, you represent everybody in that unit, and you have to speak on their behalf. So it's really important that someone comes in and understands that and know how to do that. And we work with people to try and train them to do that.
Right. I ended up representing the technical unit at that facility. It was the cardiopulmonary department. So respiratory therapists, we had a couple of assistants at one point. But anyway, the big part of how I represent the technical contract was not just my department. And that's what I'm getting at, is I had to focus on what's best for all of the departments and not just for the technical contract, but all of the departments under our entirety contract, under the professional contract, under the engineering contract, under the, was it environmental services contract?
Yeah. Sorry. As a clarification, yours was really interesting because we actually bargained 5 contracts at one time.
Yes.
Which actually at one time it was 6 that we were bargaining at one time.
Oh, yeah.
When you were at the bargaining table, it was 5. I think it was like professional service and engineering and business office, medical records, and who am I missing? There was one more. Anyway, there's 5 contracts that we were bargaining at one time.
Yeah, it was quite a bit and it was very eye-opening. But the biggest thing is that you have to focus on what's best for everybody and you have to go around and make time to talk to everyone in those other departments. And I did that in between all my breaks or before and after work or over Facebook or private email account. I would message people and say, hey, can you tell me about your department? What all do you guys do? I want to know more. I want to know about what's frustrating you right now, what you would like to have changed, what you would like to have improved. And before I even got on the bargaining team, I was actually doing that and relaying that information to my rep. And I was asking my rep all the time. I mean, I feel so bad for hounding you. I hounded you all the time asking, hey, what's the latest update on today's bargaining session? Or, hey, I heard you guys met up and had a bargaining session last week. How did that go? What did they say? What did we present? And then I actually typed it up on a paper, printed it out, took it to work, and I hung it up in our break rooms. Hey, guys, just in case you want to know, here's the update I got from our rep today regarding the bargain. Here's the latest update. And I shared that with everyone at night and day shift. And that was, I think, what helped show you guys that I was worthy to be asked to be on the bargaining team. And that was really cool. But it did have to do more of what you said. You have to put in the work. You have to show your rep that you are interested and you have to work for it. Because anyone who's on the bargaining team should have to work for that spot on that table, should have to earn it, because you're going to be working to defend their rights and to make a better contract.
Yeah. It's interesting that you use the term worthy, though, because absolutely you were worthy. You were beyond worthy. You went above and beyond in that contract. And I think sometimes during bargaining, I think people really don't understand what happens at the bargaining table, right? It's not just what happens at the table. It's what happens, what we call in the field, what happens in your department, what happens on the night shift. Is there a dialogue going on around what needs to change in your contract? And what are people willing to do to make that change happen?
Yeah.
So interesting. And another interesting thing is that when we're looking at putting together a bargaining team, it's not just the loudest people or the noisiest people, the people who people gravitate to because they take a leadership position. We want people who work well with other people in a team setting. And that's not always everybody, right? So it's important that you work well in a team, because when we're bargaining contracts, we need to go around the room and discuss things, and we want every voice to count. And as you said, you're talking on behalf of everybody, not just in the bargaining unit, but in the hospital. So it's important that people know how to fit into that team and to make that work.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because there is a lot of give and take. And how I ended up going into it for the first time, I talked with people and I made a list for my department and other departments of just 4 or 5 things. What are those 4 or 5 things that are important to you that you want changed or addressed in this new contract? And let's put them in level of importance, right? And I was so glad that I did that, because it made it easier when I sat down with everyone else at our table and we started really laying everything out of what we were going to ask for. And yeah, you can go in there and ask for 20, 30 things. But in the bargaining process, you're going to lose some of those things that you wanted, right? So you really do have to list what's the most important and go through that. And there were things that I had to say, you know what, I would love to have this for this new contract, but let's keep it for next contract. We'll keep it in the books. But for right now, that person's problem is more important. That department's issue is more important. And I want to fight for that, because that's going to have a larger positive impact on my coworkers rather than this one thing for a few people.
Yeah, that's truly what has to happen. And we do send out surveys. I think sometimes people get things in the mail and they round file them or whatever. They don't look at it. They pile their mail up and it sits there until they have to pay bills or whatever. So it's not always something people look at. So it's important that you know, that are leaders and stewards in the workplace, have that dialogue with people and say, you know, what is important to you? What are the top, you know, five or six things, which typically in the survey we send out, that's what's in it. It kind of like put it in order of importance. And sometimes it's customized to that bargaining unit if they have specific things going on. And sometimes it's more like, you know, wages, benefits, working conditions, staffing. You know, we know where the important things are these days. It's almost always wages and staffing.
It is, and healthcare costs for sure. And I'm glad you brought up surveys. I don't think people really understand why surveys are so important. And it's because we have them happen so often at work in interpersonal lives that we kind of just get burnt out on it. But with COVID restricting our reps' ability to come to a facility in person and talk to everyone face to face, there was that limitation in information sharing. And the best way to get around that are surveys. So it may seem silly, but honestly, take the extra 5 minutes out of your day to sit down and fill out that survey and submit the information to us, because we do read it, we do go through it, and we do discuss it. And it does have an impact on negotiations.
That's true. And we talk all the time as a group, because during COVID, we really had a lot of electronic surveys that we sent out because we weren't able to go in and have face-to-face conversations with people to find out what was important and what they needed. So we did electronic surveys. We sent them out in different formats. You know, I think in the beginning we have a program that we use where we can text people and we can send them a link. We can email people, but the surveys were going out in different ways. And we are constantly trying to figure out what is going to be the best way to get the surveys to people, because it is, as you said, very, because that's their opportunity. You know, every 3 years, you have an opportunity to affect your wages, your working conditions, your benefits, and you should take it. You should take that opportunity. And even if you're the busiest person on the planet, and you've heard me say this before, right? And I say it all the time. If every 3 years, people showed up to two events for a couple of hours, like if it's a informational picket or a leafleting or something like that, a march on the boss. If people showed up every couple of years and just worked, you know, with us on something, and I say us, with our stewards and with our members and our bargaining teams to try and do something, I think that they would see a difference on their paycheck and on, you know, on the other aspects of their contract that they're interested in. So every couple of years, every time we bargain that contract, just, you know, pay attention to what's going on and figure out which things you can attend. And if you can attend a CAT meeting or a picket or something like that, please do, because it makes a difference. Your employer sees it. We did a great picket at Grays Harbor when it was Grays Harbor back then.
Yes, we did.
In the middle of winter, it was like 32 degrees out and snowing. And we had three pickets, one in the morning, one midday, and one in the evening.
Yes.
And people just like showed up and they came out and they like.
And it was great.
It was fun.
I had actually mentioned it a couple of times in some of the previous episodes. And the facility that we're referring to specifically is Grays Harbor Community Hospital in Aberdeen, which is now Harbor Regional Health. This is a public community-owned facility, and unfortunately, they are so difficult with negotiations that we often have to picket there. I feel like it's a necessary process every time, and I went to the one last year, too.
Last year, it was better. It was warm weather. It was sunny.
So nice.
We were wearing shorts and t-shirts. It was really fun.
Yeah. It was, and I don't even work there anymore, and I still went. And I wasn't the only one who had left and returned to picket, because it's worth standing for our workers' rights. And I will show up every time if I can.
And in healthcare, it's really important. And it's the whole community, right? Like your community hospital. It's the same thing at all of our hospitals, really. But you show up for it. We had a lot of community people show up last year for that.
Yes, we did. We had signs in a lot of the stores midway downtown and everywhere in between. And they kept their signs up for months for us, supporting us.
Yeah. And I think that's really important. The idea that we are all working towards the same goals. And as workers, we're there, you know, you're there for your patients, right? Mm-hmm. And in the work that you do, when somebody comes in and has an emergency, you're there for them. And they know that. I think most people, particularly around healthcare workers, know that, you know, they really depend on healthcare workers, nurses, respiratory people, the people who take the x-rays, the people who work with the charts. Everybody works in concert to make sure that their health is forefront and important. So people in the community value that. It's really important. And that's why we have people from the community who show up for these things, which is great.
Yeah. And why we love our community organizing team so much, because they help bring that in and make that happen. They help make those connections with the community and with our employees
and
workers. Going back into just the basics of bargaining. Once you do sit down at the bargaining table, I know what that's like, but I want to have them hear it from you. What is it like when you sit down to bargain? Is it a bunch of people in a room? Is it always the same number of people in a room? Does everyone talk all at once? Ooh, I'm just kind of relaying some of the questions I've heard from people. Can you just say whatever you want, whenever? Is it like TV where people are throwing their fist down on the table and saying, this is absolutely nonsense?
Sometimes it is. Generally, well, I don't know that there's a generally. There isn't really a rule book, but we do try and keep it civilized and somewhat respectful. There is a time where, you know, one side or the other isn't getting what they want, or there's some problems with respect. You will see, you know, raised voices, and that's normal, I think.
I think so,
but
too.
We try and stay respectful for the most part.
I think we stay very professional. We have raised our voices. I know I've dropped a cuss word or two. I am a frequent cusser, and I try my best not to, but yeah, I'm a frequent flyer in the realm of cussing.
I never had to represent you at a meeting because you got in trouble for cursing. I never did. So just, thanks. You know, not so much. It wasn't like I had to filter you at all. So,
No. Yeah. It was more of just when you are really frustrated and you've been at the issue for such a long time, and in our case, well over a year, and feeling just disrespected every time management came in to give a, and I'm saying this with quotations in the air, proposal. Mm-hmm. It was just ridiculous. It was hard not to cuss and not to get heated and everything. But even then, we did keep it as professional as we could. And we actually went around before the employer and their team was brought in, and we had an opportunity to say what we wanted to with our lawyer to make sure that what we were saying was accurate, what we were saying was respectful, and what we were saying was valid and necessary and needed to be said. And that was nice, because in that instance, it can be intimidating to stand up to your employer, because you're standing up to the CEO, you're standing up sometimes to the CNO, the CFO, so the chief financial officer, the chief nursing officer, you're standing up to the head of HR and their lawyer, and you're voicing your concerns and your frustrations. And that can be a difficult thing to do. And if you're not comfortable doing that, that's okay. There's a workaround. And the workaround is the lawyer that our union brings in to sit through this whole process with our team. And they say, you know what, if you don't want to say it, I would love to say it for you. And they'll type it up, they'll write it down to make sure that they say word for word exactly what you want. And that was a really nice part that I didn't expect.
Yeah, sometimes it's a negotiator. Sometimes we have attorneys at the table who also negotiate. We have a couple attorneys who also sit at some of our tables. The negotiator typically for the union side is a chief spokesperson, and we will call on our bargaining team members to talk about certain things, to talk about what's important, and to give examples of, you know, why we need to change something in the contract. If there's a staffing issue, they can give examples of what the staffing issue is. As you know, we've done that with you and some of your teammates. So we're the spokespeople on that side, and we'll assign people to take that role on or to express themselves. In some situations, we invite other people to come to the table. There generally has to be mutual agreement for that to happen. We can't just like bring in 100 people. I mean, we could. I don't want to give away any secrets, but maybe that's something we'll do in the future. But generally, we have a set of proposals that we plan on giving the employer, and we review it with the team. We spend a lot of time on those proposals, making sure that what we want to see in this contract is what we all want to see in the contract, that we all agree on everything and that we have consensus on everything. And so we will then make proposals to the employer. A lot of times the employer will come back and just say, we're not interested. It's not important to us. It may be important to you, but it's not important to us. And one of our roles as the negotiators is to determine from those conversations what the employer wants at the table, because almost always the employer will come to the table with something in mind that they need to get during this bargain. And also to change their mind on the things that they don't. So that's our role, is to make sure that they understand what we need to have in this contract and for us to understand what they want.
It is.
Because without the employer, we're not going to have an agreement. So we have to look at both sides and try and figure it out and balance it. But we also have to convince them if we think something's really important. We have to convince them of that. And that's where we have our members who will sit at the table and hopefully, you know, if they're comfortable, step up and talk about what is important and what give the examples of issues that they've had that have led us to the point where we want to make these proposals. We want to change the contract or add something to the contract that's going to make it a better contract for everybody.
Yeah. And the proposals, just to be clear, for everyone. The proposals are created pretty much immediately from the beginning. And how that happens is our negotiator from the union will sit with us along with a lawyer, and we go around and each individual will bring up their concerns and things they want to change, right? We list that out, and then we take out the contract and we go through everyone's contract line by line, word by word, and really break everything down. We'll read a sentence and go, okay, is there anything wrong with that sentence? Do we want to change that sentence? Is it one word that we want to change? Because changing something to a simple word as may or can work to our advantage, right? So you go through that contract cover to cover, and it's not just once. It's sometimes 100 times. And as you go through that, they're taking notes on things that we want to change, and then they are actively rewriting everything. And that's our lawyer that rewrites it, correct? Or is it sometimes you?
Often it's the negotiator. I mean, typically, okay, it depends on what you're talking about. Some of the language in the contract, we run by the attorney to
make sure, it's legal.
Particularly things around healthcare or pension, things that are really important that we get the legal language written down.
Right.
But typically the negotiator does write it. And we, you know, I think you're right. We do what we call a contract audit. So mm-hmm. we'll sit down with the bargaining team and we'll go through the whole contract, and you know, that might take a couple of hours. It might take a couple of days. We may have to spend a couple of days on trying to figure it out, particularly because as we have different things come up, mm-hmm. we might want to change the contract and craft it in a different way or focus it in a different way. In the last few years, we've been very focused on staffing. And as you know, there's a staffing crisis in the country right now, and mm-hmm. we are short literally hundreds of thousands of nurses and techs and other people, and many people in low wage jobs like who work in cafeterias in the hospitals or who are EVS, environmental services people, mm-hmm. there's a shortage because, you know, quite frankly, the employers were paying them nothing or very low wages. And many people can go, they can work in fast food. They can go work at McDonald's and make $20 an hour, and the hospital is paying them $18. So why wouldn't they take the easier job, particularly when we have something like COVID?
Exactly.
Where you're like, your life is on the line every time you show up from work. I was working with some laundry workers in a hospital recently who said to me, everybody in our department who worked with the laundry got COVID.
Jeez.
I know. So, you know, now employers are realizing that they can't, particularly in healthcare, that they can't just hire people at minimum wage and expect that they're going to do this work where they are at risk every day. They're with patients who may or may not be, you know.
It boiled down to we as a community started calling out our employers from creating a toxic, underpaid work environment.
That's right.
And we all said, you know what? I don't need to stay for this. I don't need to continue working for you in this environment, and left. Right. And it's really frustrating because they did this to everyone, the employers, right? They created this. And unfortunately, we just took a really long time to stand up for ourselves and stand up for each other. And a lot of us have maintained our licensures in different fields and professions. But until that environment is fixed, a lot of them are not coming back. And I get it. Mm-hmm. I absolutely get it.
Particularly the low-wage workers. I'm talking about workers who may, you know, who have traditionally made wage.
Yeah.
And they're doing work which, you know, requires some skill. And at this point is somewhat risky, but I, you know, employers are seeing that. And what I've seen in the last maybe 2 years is that they're coming to us and saying, we know we have to pay more. We know we have to raise the bottom up. We need to make sure that our lowest wage workers are making X amount of dollars because we can't get anyone in the door.
Yeah.
They know that. They get it.
Yeah. And the best way to do that is on those contract proposals. Each proposal is basically another copy of the contract. And it can either be the entire contract, depending on the proposal, or it could just be a portion of it. I know oftentimes with our bargaining team, it was just a small portion. For example, we did wage scales as one singular portion because it was such a hot topic of discussion.
Right.
And that needed all of our focus. Another portion was healthcare. Another portion was overtime and on call and standby. And those topics of discussion. And each proposal is written out, right, legally. And you have the standard language in black writing. And then whatever you changed was underlined and in bright red so that everyone knew exactly what it was we were wanting to change in that proposal. And it was presented by our union rep and our lawyer. And sometimes an individual from the bargaining team would also say something in presenting this. But normally it was just everyone on the bargaining team sitting there in unison, but silently supporting this proposal. It would go to the employer. We would all read it out loud together so that if the employer or their lawyer had a question about it, they could ask our lawyer and our team would be witness to everything. There's no sidebar discussions happening at these bargaining units, right? Everything is done collectively as a whole. and right in front of everyone. Once you do a read through, the other team will leave, and the other team meaning the employer. And then there's that waiting game. It's the hurry up and wait game. It's the hurry up and get a proposal out and make sure that it's detailed enough. But also, now you got to wait. And the ball is in the other person's court, whoever received the proposal. So they now have control. And they often would make us wait all day long just to come back to us at 3, 4, sometimes as late as 5 in the afternoon. So you know what? We were done. They already left. And we didn't know. We sat there. There's an instance where that employer actually left the facility. Just flat out left and didn't even have the professional courtesy to tell us that they were done bargaining for the day. So then we lose that time. We lose that time with our families. We lose that time just in working or sleep before we go to work our shift. Mm-hmm. It was very frustrating. And what we were waiting for was for the employer to come back to the table with a reasonable response to the proposal, which is their counter proposal if they don't want to accept the one that we gave them. And that's how the process works. And it's a bunch of back and forth. And you sit there and they read through it, then they leave and you discuss it as a whole. And sometimes you start out going, you know what, this doesn't sound so bad. Wait a minute. Why doesn't this sound so bad?
And you realize.
You realize they snuck something in there.
Negative impact.
Yeah. Or one word that may, that nasty word may or can work in the employer's favor just as easily as it can work for the employee's favor. Right. And so we would go back through it. And it's a bunch of back and forth. And other than the arguing, the other thing that I ended up learning that we could do that I wasn't aware of in this process is that you can ask for the finances, right?
If the employer is saying that they don't have any money, we can go back to them and say, we'd like you to show us your finances. And actually, many times, if the employer is having financial issues, they will just, you know, they'll volunteer the information.
But sometimes they do it.
It's a PowerPoint.
It is a PowerPoint. And they did do that at one instance where they did it kind of in a shady way. They weren't being honest about everything. The numbers were not all there. Mm-hmm. And they hemmed and hawed, and then they never supplied us with what we had asked for. But honestly, it's also public record. You can go to the Department of Health website and type in the search bar, hospital finances. And did you know that you can find financial data on almost every single hospital medical facility?
Yeah, I mean, actually all of them, but public districts are pretty easy because it's all public information.
Yeah, so you can use that as a bargaining tool when you're sitting down to go into this bargaining with this employer.
Right, and that makes a difference. If the top five people in the organization, like the CEO, the CFO, the CNO, whoever the top five paid people are listed, particularly if you're going to look at, I know in public district hospitals, you can always find that pretty accessible.
You can see their base scale, wage scale, right? And then you get to see this nifty thing called bonuses and non-taxable dollars that get added to their accounts. And the next thing you know, they're making almost $100,000 more than what they claim they were.
Yeah.
So they sit there and claim, well,
we don't have any money.
Well really, because you've made $200,000 more than you did the previous year.
Right.
And collectively, you made well over $500,000 more just in your C-suite than you did the previous year. So how can you come back and tell me you can't afford to pay your workers a reasonable, livable wage scale, but you can afford to give yourselves a $500,000 raise?
That is the question. And that's,
during COVID?
That's why we look at those things. That's why we have the opportunity to say, you know, if they're claiming that they don't have money, then we can look at the information that they send us. And by the way, we do have the right to request information, and they have the right to request information from us, and they legally have to provide it to us. Sometimes it takes a while to get it, and that is a little hindering.
When they are legally bound to supply it, is there a time frame that's mentioned in that?
Typically not. I mean, I think you could probably go after it if it was unreasonably delayed, or, you know, if it's relevant to the information that you need to be able to bargain a contract. I think you could probably make an argument that they need to provide it in a timely way because of this. Now, employers a lot of times will come back and say, you know, that's they like the word burdensome. That's a burdensome request that you're making.
I found a hate for a word I didn't know I had.
And they'll, you know, or they'll say, we will provide it to you, but we won't get it to you for, you know, 60 days or whatever. And so then you have to figure out how that works. So it could delay you a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, because if you have already negotiated the rest of the contract and you just have that one section left, now they've successfully delayed another 60 days. And you might be asking yourself, well, other than waiting, how is that a negative thing or a big deal? It's a big deal because it allows more time to pass, which could potentially allow for a different union's contract to expire. And then they can pit the two unions against each other which yeah. is their technique that they try to do. But what we did is we actually worked together.
Yeah.
Right. We talked.
Yeah. It's helpful if you can do that. And we have a good relationship with, I would say, I can't think of a union that we don't. We have a good relationship with all the unions.
Yeah. So and it's so beneficial because then we can
call them up.
Yeah.
And say, and in fact, I was talking to a negotiator from another union where we're in bargaining and they're in bargaining and we're, you know, at the same time. And that's great because we can find out, well, where's the employer at? Where are they at with this? Mm-hmm. I will tell you that right now in this time frame, it's not in their best interest, in my opinion, to wait or to delay or to say it's going to take a while to get you this because they can't hire anyone.
Exactly.
They're paying so much for travelers right now.
A ton.
And even though the traveler rates vary, depending mm-hmm. on the company they work for and how high the need is, it's still more expensive. And they are acknowledging that. And so a lot of employers are just trying to get them settled. They're trying to get these contracts settled.
The smart ones are.
I'm not going to get into that.
I know, I'm sorry.
Have to make a list. And here's my list of the smart ones.
I have such a long list. Yeah, you're right. The smart ones are doing that. But it also speaks volumes to travelers who do talk to each other and say, hey, you don't want to go to this and that facility because yeah. they don't value their employees.
They can't even get travelers.
Yeah.
No?
And that is correct.
You
and
know.
It's for, yes, I do know. It is so hard. I would love to just have a session to really just lay it all out there, but it's not beneficial.
Yeah,
and it right. goes away from the whole purpose of this podcast is, and you know, maybe someday I will.
Maybe someday you will.
Yeah, maybe someday I will.
Love that dialogue. Yeah. There, I think that the important thing about bargaining is, you know, it's more than just creating a new contract and coming up with a bunch of words on a piece of paper. It's kind of like the rules. I always think of it as the rules the employer has to live by. Right?
Yeah.
You have to live by them too. But the employer has to follow some rules. And workplaces where people don't have contracts, they don't have any rules. The employer can do whatever they want. It's hire and fire at will in a lot of cases.
Right.
And they can pay you whatever you want. If you go to a state where there isn't a lot of union density, people make less. I mean, like
a right to work state, which I believe would be Idaho is one of them. Texas,
sure,
I think, is another.
There are a bunch of states that have different laws around unions.
Mm-hmm.
And an example I will give you, I was telling someone the other day, is that we had a surgery tech, this was a number of years ago, who moved from Washington State to her home state of Louisiana and moved to New Orleans, which is, you know, it's not a cheap place to live. New Orleans is kind of spendy, I think.
Yeah.
And her wages were cut in half. At the time when she left, she was making around $27, $28 an hour. And she moved to New Orleans and she took a job and she texted me. She said, I just took a job and my wages are going to be 14 and change. And that's
oh
for
gosh.
Somebody who has education, who has years of experience, but she, you know, she moved back because she needed to. And she had family was important to her, but it's the difference between having a union and not having
yeah. when you have someone to fight for livable wage scales for you and fight for you to protect your job and to say, you know what, you can't just fire an employee because you decided you don't like them today.
And that's right.
That's one of the nice things. And you can't fire an employee because they refuse to stay late or
right.
work an overtime shift.
Right. I mean, and I think the important piece is not just in the union facilities, you know, but where we have higher union density and in healthcare in Washington State, it's high.
Mm-hmm.
We force non-union employers to pay more. So
that's true.
Where, you know, where you're competing with the union employers, you have to keep a higher standard to get people. And in many cases, they are trying to raise the bar even more because it's harder to get employees to come and work in a non-union facility once they work union, is my opinion. I mean, you know,
I agree with you. And I'm actually really glad that you mentioned that because that was a point that I forgot to think about bringing up, you know, in our outline. I think that's a very valid reason that unions not only benefit the unionized facilities, but also the non-unionized, because like you said, that bar is raised.
Yeah. And not just in healthcare. I mean, in retail, in grocery,
yes.
In a lot of the industries, yeah, coffee shops. In a lot of the industries, yeah,
and
where you have competition, you know, those employers have to work harder.
Yeah, they absolutely do. When the employers are being difficult during contract negotiations, what are some of the things that we do to change that?
Well, that's a good question.
I can think of one that you actually mentioned earlier, and I wrote it down so that I could bring it back up to kind of circle back to it.
Yeah.
And that was when we marched on the CEO and
yeah.
presented him with some paperwork that
order,
I think was,
right? Wasn't it It was a petition.
It was a petition, and we had signatures, and it was a letter, and it was all the things. And then on top of that, my coworker and I gave our 2 cents, mm-hmm. very verbatim, and it was professional.
Yeah.
But it was a push, and that push was needed. And that was before we started picketing. It was, hey, you need to listen to your employees. You need to say something to your lawyer who's negotiating for your bargaining team, because your bargaining team is being ridiculous. They're coming back at us with...
You're talking about management.
Yeah. Management, correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, they're coming back to us with proposals that were not even proposals, basically refusing to even go anywhere or make any kind of movement or headway on negotiations. We were done. We were frustrated. Mm-hmm. It's time to move on to the next step. So that's kind of what I'm bringing up is our next step options. We do sticker up.
Mm-hmm.
What is sticker up?
What for is sticker listening? Up? Oh, so, you know, and a lot of times we will start with something small, like a sticker up mm-hmm. or a button up.
Yeah.
And that's where we distribute little stickers or buttons that people wear that say, you know, I support my bargaining team. That's the very basic one that we will put out. Or maybe it's stronger. Maybe it's management needs to listen or...
I can think of one. Mm-hmm. Safe staffing saves lives.
That was a really good one.
That was a big one. And you know, the typical stickers where they say my name is and you're supposed to write your name on it. And one of my favorite ones is where they wrote a name and they crossed it out and it said, short staffed, overworked, underpaid. And we had those ones. And that gets your patients' attention.
Yeah.
That gets your community's attention. We had big signs that I know we put in our car. I actually bought paint markers and wrote and drew on my windows in my car. And you can bet that absolutely got the community's attention. When you're at Safeway or at a grocery store in a parking lot, someone says, hey, what's with the writing on your window, on your car? Yeah. What's going on? Can you tell me more about that? And I got asked every day.
Yeah.
And those are some of our major techniques, right? Sometimes we go to the radio station. We go to the media. We go to the local newspaper.
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of different directions you can take it. Like I said, we usually start with something small just to get people used to the idea that they can actually do something and it's totally fine, right?
Yeah.
There's no issue. And then we elevate, we escalate, and we do things that are maybe a little bit more difficult, like petitions, a march on the boss. One thing that I did want to say, and you may have covered this in another podcast, is that when you are working with your coworkers and working on a project together to try and change something in the workplace, it's concerted activity, it's protected activity under the law. So, you know, people don't have to be afraid. Now, I mean, you know, there are limits to that, you know.
Right.
And that's why when you're working together, you decide as a group, when we're in bargaining, we decide as a group what we're going to do, what's the next action. And it's protected by law. So it's really important that people know that. You're not going to get into any trouble because you are working in concert with other people. You know, you're working together with other people on concerted collective activity, and you can't, it's protected by law. So
yeah, your right to wear that button, wear that sticker is protected by law. And that's what she's referencing directly.
And when you were talking about talking across the table, when you were, you know, when we come to our bargaining team and say, okay, we need to talk about your experience with stuff to the other side of the table, which is made up, right? When we're in the middle of the bargaining process and, you know, you're getting a little bit upset or you're getting a little bit emotional. Well, you're working, you know, you're like a union person when you do that. You're working as an equal across the table with the people who are the CEO and the CFO. You know, they should not be getting mad at you. You shouldn't have to worry about repercussions. The law protects you. And you have the right to do that work without it coming back to you and harming you in some way.
Correct.
So I think that's something that people need to understand.
They absolutely do. And I'm glad you brought that up because I kind of lightly covered that, but not as in depth, which I think is beneficial for everyone to hear.
Yeah. If you go to the National Labor Relations Board website, there's sort of some like in plain English, like not legal speak.
Layman's terms
about your rights to take action and to be a part of a union and all of that stuff. So I encourage people to do that. And we have a lot of information on our website.
UFCW3000.org.
Very good. Thank you. Glad you know that. That's awesome.
I like to repeat that as often as possible on here, just to remind everyone that that resource is there.
Right.
And there is a ton of helpful information that would be good for you to know. So whenever you get a few extra minutes or you're just looking for something to do, go ahead and go onto the website, check it out, dig through it. It has a lot of information like that about that. And another thing I wanted to bring up is the difference between informational picketing and going on strike and when you can and can't go on strike. strike and why not?
That's some big talkages.
No, those are
topic.
Some,
that's a lot.
That's a lot. We'll start with the difference between picketing and striking.
What I can tell you is that you have the right to informational picketing. Every contract is different. So there's language in your contract really talks about what you can and can't do while your contract is live and happening and active. Mm-hmm. And there are things you can't do. You know, and informational picketing is generally one of the things that we can do. We look at every contract and make sure that we can before we do anything like that. And informational picketing is where we take our fight out to the streets and we give the employer appropriate notice and send them an official letter saying that we're going to be picketing on such and such a date between this hour and this hour. And then we gather people together and get the word out that that's what we're going to do. We do try and follow it fairly closely and make sure that we are sticking to what we told the employer we would do to try and keep it legal and safe. And then we have a picket line just like you would if you were on strike. Now, a strike is entirely different. And that is where decide you're going to start as a group, decide. And there's a vote on that. And you vote to stop working and keep the employer from, you know, pretty much doing business because they can't function without you. And so that's a little bit different. There are a lot of rules around actual strikes. And I think that's a whole chapter in itself. I don't know that I want to get into that too much. It really isn't as much about bargaining, although it is something that people think a lot about. We do believe that there is a time and a place for that. Not always, not every day, but we can get as much leverage from a nice picket, an informational picket, than we can from an actual strike sometimes, in my opinion.
Yeah.
We've seen a lot of contracts change, so we will tell an employer, you know, we are going to picket on this date between the hours of this and that. And many times an employer doesn't want that bad press. They don't want the community to be that engaged. They don't want that out there. And so they will contact us. And sometimes it's like, you know, the night before, we had that happen that was a full strike. We almost had a grocery strike some years ago now. Mm-hmm. And we got down to, we had a clock set up. It was a 72-hour countdown. And we were almost at the point where we went on strike. And the employer then came to us kind of in the 11th hour and said, you know, let's sit down at the table and see if we can resolve this. And employers, they don't want the bad press. They don't want the bad notoriety.
Correct. And that happens a lot. We find that informational picketing is just enough to push for a win on a contract and avoid going on strike.
And sometimes that's helpful. And not always. I mean, you know, the employers sometimes pretend they don't care.
Right.
Like, and we don't care that you're out there picketing. Even though we know that they're looking through the blinds, you know, they're peeking through the blinds and watching.
Oh, yeah.
And they have all their security people ready to go. But yeah, sometimes the employers say, we don't care.
Yeah. And honestly, it's just a step in the process. It's respectful when we do informational picketing. We do make sure it's safe and legal. We do not block entryways or exits or ambulances or emergency services.
We have people who their job is just like security, more or less, that are keeping it safe. Let's keep it safe.
Very safe. It's very organized.
It's very organized. It's fun.
People bring
their kids. They bring their dogs. They bring their grandpa. They bring everybody to the picket. It's really fun.
Yeah. And it's nice because it encourages the community to walk up and ask us questions. And that happens at all the pickets that I've gone to where the community will be walking by or driving by, the cars will stop for a second, roll their windows down and say, hey, what's going on? And it's a great way to spread that information.
Or they'll drive by and honk. That's always fun.
Yeah.
And you see it in, you know, there are so many communities, and yours, the community that you live in is one, mm-hmm. where there are a lot of union workers.
Yeah, and from other unions that come in.
They come in. And we will invite people from the community to come to our picket. Mm-hmm. And they do. And we have a great relationship with the community. So
people
show up for us just like we show up for them. So.
Exactly. And when we picket, this is something that we do before work, after work, or on your break. You cannot miss work or call out to do this.
For an informational picket.
Informational picket. Now, if you're on strike, that's different.
A little different. That's another episode.
All right. We'll keep that for another episode. I'm happy with that.
You know, we don't have a lot of strikes, but we do a lot of informational picketing and we do make a lot of noise.
And honestly, I think it's best that we don't have a lot of strikes because that can really negatively impact a ton of people and a community. And we don't want to do that. We want to keep things in a more positive light and a positive direction. So if we can avoid escalation that far and come to an agreement, that is the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
We don't want to fight and cause negativity.
Right.
We want a reasonable, good quality contract that's going to benefit everybody as a whole. That's what we want. And that's the intent of everything.
And to be clear, we do not ever intend to negatively impact an employer's business. Like, we don't want them losing business. If it's a hospital, we don't want them, we don't want people to go to another hospital.
Yeah.
We don't want people to say it's not safe there. We want people to know the people who work here are great and they're really good at their jobs. Sometimes there's not enough of them.
They just need more support.
They need more support and they need higher wages.
Yeah.
But we never go out and try and like negatively impact the employer's business, no matter what. Like I said, whether it's retail, whether it's healthcare, laundry, any other industry that we're working, our intent is to get the employer to change their practice, not to get rid of their business. Because obviously, if they lose business, then people
we lose our jobs.
We're not after that.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm glad that we covered that because that was something I wanted to cover as well.
And people ask me that all the time. People say to me, well, I don't know if I want to come to the picket because I don't want it to have a bad effect on my employer.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is we're not out to get rid of their business. We're out to make their business stronger.
Yeah, make it better.
Make it better. Make your employer a better employer.
Yes.
And what patient or customer, depending on what industry you're in, what patient or customer doesn't want an employer that is good so that when they walk in, they can get the help that they need, whether no matter what the business is.
Yeah.
They can get exactly what they need and that they've got good, knowledgeable people who are safe, doing their job safely, and who come to work every day happy to be there.
It makes a big difference when you're around someone who's happy to be at work and doing their job. Everyone can tell.
That's right.
What are some other common misconceptions regarding bargaining that we could address and maybe clear up for our listeners?
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of them.
I'm sure there's a lot, but just any that kind of come to mind.
I think I already mentioned the fact that if you are a bargaining team member and you're on a bargaining team, you don't just come there to represent your group of people. You're there for everybody in the bargaining unit. You talked a little bit about that. I think that's super important. I think the conversation that our members have with the employer is so important during bargaining. And I prefer when we have members who do a lot of talking at the bargaining table to explain what to tell their story to the employer and let the employer know what's going on. You know, when you're sitting across the table from the CFO, the CEO, the CNO, these are not people who are working side by side with you when you're sterilizing instruments in a hospital or when you are working an all-night shift in a grocery store. The people who are sitting across from you are the people who make the big bucks, who haven't maybe done the work. Maybe they have, maybe they haven't. But they don't know what you do on a day-by-day basis. And I have recently started making sure that when we do introductions, the first day of bargaining, that I have our bargaining team members talk a little bit about what they do. Not just who they are and how long they work there, but what do you do?
Mm-hmm.
What's important? Why are you here at the table? So that the employer, the CNO, the CFO, whoever it is, who's sitting across from you, understands the work a little bit. And during bargaining, I think it's really important that we explain to the employer how the decisions that they make, the people across the table, impact the day-by-day operation of that employment group, whoever it is, all of the workers, right?
And that's huge. And another thing I wanted to bring up that may sound kind of silly that I didn't realize, but one of the things I didn't realize when I went into bargaining is you can literally ask for anything. And it's really cool to hear what other things are asked for in contract negotiations that are put into someone's contract. What are some cool things that you are proud of as a bargainer for getting into a contract?
You know, people don't think about this. They think about their wages or how long their break is.
Mm-hmm.
But we're doing a lot of work around equity, internal equity, and safety. Uh-huh. Making sure there's good safety language in contracts.
Making sure there's training for de-escalation.
We just bargained a contract where we bargained in some language for safety for workers who go into people's homes, who are home health people.
Oh.
So yes, not just de-escalation, but the safety aspect of, you know, what do you look for? You know, how do you make sure that you are walking into, in that case, a situation where you're not in danger. For home health workers, I've worked with some home health workers actually a couple of years ago who talked to me about how they've walked into people's homes where everybody in the home is an addict. And the patient may be someone who is terminally ill and they're on hospice. And so that person walking into the home has to determine in the household who is the safest person to give the medications to.
Wow.
So yeah, I think that all of our members are dealing every day with different things And we don't always know what they are. But something like that, if we can add some language to the contract that makes them safer when they walk in the door and have de-escalation training, which you talked about, mm-hmm. which is kind of talking someone down who is
hostile.
You've dealt with that.
Absolutely. Sure. A huge thing in grocery stores and yep. medical facilities. Other things that we've asked for, education.
Education.
You can get extra education funds added yep. to your contract so that you can...
Or funds for right. education.
Right. So healthcare workers, we have to have hours of education to support our license every 1 to 2 years, right? Mm-hmm. CEUs are yep. what they called.
Right.
Continuing education.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
And one way to get that is if you're lucky enough that to find it in your contract will say, hey, you have $300 a year to spend on going to an education conference
right.
to support your license. That's
right.
something you can get added into your contract, which I think
right.
is just so cool.
Yeah.
Another thing you can get added into your contract is union leave.
Union leave is important. Yeah.
That's time loss. Right. And I think that's a cool thing to put into a contract.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there are a lot of things that we can put into contracts. There are different funds that you can access. The training and education funds, I think, are really, really important. And if you have them in the contract, it is just so great, the more you have. And, you know, some other things that are valuable, like certification pay.
Yeah.
If you have a certification that somehow could benefit the employer, you can make an extra dollar an hour because you're certified.
Exactly.
Or more, depending on what you have.
Or if you have a bachelor's degree in something or a master's degree.
If you're multilingual.
Yes.
We're actually getting multilingual pay in a lot of our contracts. So the employer benefits because mm-hmm. you can communicate with people and that's really beneficial to the employer. And so they'll pay you a little bit of extra money to help with that.
Yeah. Right? And a great way to find out more information on things you can ask for, you can go to ufcw3000.org
yep.
or you can call up your union rep or email your union rep, whatever works better for you, and ask them. Say, hey, I know you cover a lot of contracts. What is something that was bargained for in one of your contracts that you find really beneficial that maybe could also benefit my facility?
Yeah.
Or can you give me an idea of a contract that I can read to get more information? Or just take it upon yourself, take some of the extra initiative and start reading contracts.
Right. All of our contracts are on the website. So if you know of a contract, if you work at, a hospital in Olympia, say, and you know there's a hospital in Everett that you're interested in reading their contract, just go to our website.
Yeah. Also a neat way to check out a facility before changing employers.
Yeah.
Check out their contract. You can see what the wage scale is. You can have that information handy when you sit down with HR and they start bringing up your pay scale and they ask how much you want to be paid. You can say, I want to be
sure.
paid to scale. And yeah. you already have that information in your back pocket. You know exactly what they should be offering you.
Right. Can I tell you one of the most exciting things, though, about bargaining?
Yes, please.
yes, we come together typically every about 3 years and bargain a new union contract.
Mm-hmm.
And we come together and we gather folks together who sit on our bargaining teams, who sit on our CAT teams, which is our contract action teams. And we hold meetings, we do, informational pickets, we wear buttons, we do whatever it takes to get a good contract. But the actual process of bargaining and all of these different things that we do to bring people together every 3 years, to me, is the most exciting thing. It's the most exciting thing when I see people who want to see change, who step up and try and make that change happen, right?
Whether it is
they're
incredible.
Whether they're on a CAT team, whether they're on the bargaining team, whether they're just somebody holding a sign when we're walking up and down the street, no matter who it is, it's great to see the community and to see people within a workplace just come together and stand up for something that they believe in.
That's a beautiful point.
I mean,
I really like it, and it's
really
valid.
I mean, bargaining can be stressful. It can be
exciting,
emotional. It can be fun.
Mm-hmm.
It can be all of these different things. But to me, seeing everyone come together for the same thing to try and accomplish one big thing, and that is to get a good contract, there are no words for it.
It's an incredible thing to witness and be a part of. Absolutely
mm-hmm.
is.
Yeah.
If your contract is expired, does that mean you don't have a contract covering you?
That'd be a long conversation too. So the quick answer.
Yes, quick answer.
Quick answer is we can get extensions on contracts and try and do that.
And basically when it does expire, it doesn't mean that contract is no longer valid.
That's right.
You fall back to the most recent contract.
Right.
Every time. And that's what stays, even if it's for 1, 2, 3 years of bargaining, which we
yeah.
hope it doesn't take that long. But sometimes
right.
sometimes it takes a period of time. But just so that you have that information in the back of your brain. Just because your contract's expired doesn't mean you no longer have union rights. You still right. have those.
Almost everything is still intact. Almost yeah. everything. When the contract does expire. And we typically try and get extensions if the employer will agree. And that brings up another point, and that is when we bargaining isn't just us. Mm-hmm. It's us with the employer trying to put something together and make something happen. And so the really tricky thing is to get the employer to agree
yes.
to what we want to do. And that's why having our members at the table, or when we deliver a letter, or when we wear a button, if you're wearing a button in your department, and your manager comes up and goes, what's with the butt? And you say, hey, we're in contract negotiations and we really need to change the staffing in the contract, the language on staffing in the contract. And somehow that's just not happening. It creates a dial, right?
It does, between employees and their management.
And each other.
And
the community.
It does. If you are bargaining and a member of your bargaining team moves or gets a new job or just doesn't want to be a part of that process anymore, is their seat automatically filled, or how does that
question.
Work?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes if you're really deep into bargaining, it's hard to bring a new team member in to fill a spot. Now, it depends on the situation. Sometimes we will bring somebody in, depends on how far into bargaining we are, depends on how many people we have on the team. Do we have someone else who can cover that piece of it? Do we have enough people who are doing the work that are, you know, representing everybody in the unit? And yeah, I mean, sometimes we can add people and sometimes it's not appropriate to do that.
It is very much a situation by situation basis.
Yeah.
And it depends on how far into the process you are.
Yeah.
If it's early on, sure, you can change someone out if that's what your team wants to do as a whole to make sure that's all covered.
Yeah. That's
necessary.
A good point. We make decisions as a team. So the team would weigh into that.
Yeah. Everything is discussed as a cohesive unit first before anything is done.
Yeah.
And more often than not, those holes are not filled until the next contract negotiation session. Because
it's hard
too much
when you're
to sit there and give a year's worth of information to someone and have them really understand
or
everything.
Or even if it's not that long. You know, once you've exchanged initial proposals, and typically what happens is one side or the other will make a proposal. Usually the union makes a first proposal and gives something to the employer. The employer responds, you know, depending on the contract, we either give them everything or we give them part of it, non-economic and economic. And then once there's that back and forth dialogue going on and you've exchanged a few proposals, it's really hard to bring someone in. And not that they wouldn't be welcome, but when they come in, they usually say, well, why don't we propose this? Everyone on the team looks at them and says, you know, we've had this conversation. Thank you for asking the question, but we've had this conversation, but it is difficult to bring someone up to speed. So we don't always replace people.
Yeah. It can slow down the process. It can make it less productive and drag things along. But
from start to finish, I will give you like the kind of summary. We send out some notifications to people that we're about to begin bargaining. We usually involve the rep in talking about who the team's going to be. The rep, you know, is involved in that conversation and talks about who's been involved and who, you know, who's a steward, who's not. Can we try and pull people from different areas? If we have a huge lab in a hospital, or if we have one whole a big department, if it's not healthcare, it's another area. We try and pull from those areas so that we have representatives from different areas. We try and figure out how big the team is going to be. If you have a team that's huge, you're going to be bargaining for a lot longer because we want to hear everyone's voice. We have to make sure everyone's heard. So it's really important that we get the right size team for the unit. And then we do, as you said, we do the contract audit. We go through, we make initial proposals, we figure out if that's everything we want to give. And then typically the employer says no to a bunch of stuff and we have to reinvent the wheel. We have to rewrite stuff and try and convince them that this is what we need. And some things we don't reinvent the wheel. We just say, nope, we're holding on this. We want this in the contract and we're going to keep pushing it till we get it. And then we get into economics. That's a little trickier. We typically look at what the market is. And by that, I mean, if you're in healthcare, that's like what are surrounding hospitals or other healthcare units, clinics, what are they paying and all that stuff. And we make proposals back and forth. And then we kind of whittle them down and come to agreement on things. And then we go around and make sure that everybody at the table is in agreement to what we've got. We call it a recommended offer or not. If we say, no, it's not a recommended offer, but we'll vote it, then that's another possibility. Then we have a vote and every union member who's an active union member gets to vote on it. And then it becomes a contract once it's voted, if it's a yes.
Yeah. And one very last thing, when we go to vote for a contract, if we're voting yes or no, depending on the recommendation,
Yep.
That is when we finally get to see a draft of the contract, right, that we're voting on.
This is the big question. I know what you're going to ask me. Go ahead.
Why can't we give a copy of that contract that we're voting on out to the employees ahead of time, like maybe a week in advance?
That's a good question. And I mean that sincerely, because I think that there's some nuances to that. One is, we want the bargaining team, who typically attend the vote, to walk people through the process, particularly if it was a long and difficult bargain, or if we have things in the contract that are maybe not so easy to understand. Like, why did we do this?
Mm-hmm.
It gives the people who are bargaining the contract the opportunity to say, you know, we struggled with this because if we did this, it might have had a negative impact on this group over here. You know, because in some departments, in some units, there may be something that you really want in the contract, but if you put that in, like scheduling, for example, you put in a particular process for scheduling, and that works for everybody except, you know, this department over here.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to try and figure out what's the best language for everyone, or we do kind of carve out language for particular groups if we think that there's good general language and we need something for a particular group. But we can't really explain that to people if we're just sending them something in the mail, right?
True.
So that is, I think, the main thing. It's a really difficult question because I see both sides of it and I understand why people would want to read things over. I think there are some things that people could read over and totally get and not have any questions about. And other things they would be like, you know.
But being on the other side of the table on the bargaining team and having fought for all of that, I didn't want people to misunderstand what they were reading and make an assumption and then go around and spread that falsehood, which can happen.
It does happen.
And I think not having it out early cuts down on misinformation.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is probably the number one reason why we don't. I mean, the contract, as you said earlier, is kind of lots of legalese and, you know, complicated and written in a way, in a certain way, and one word can make all the difference in the world. And sometimes we change things in contracts and you may not even notice what the change is because it might just be a typo or, you know, it might be something where we think the wording would be better served if it were like this.
Right.
And it's a challenging thing for us. And we typically do a sort of an overview page that we give to people.
Yeah, quick like bullet points of, hey, here's the highlights of the things that we changed.
The contract, right? And then we do what's called a red line, which is like, here's all the changes.
Yep.
So you can see them. And we provide you with both so you can look at that. That's typically our process.
Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your day meeting with me. It did, didn't it?
It did.
It's so hard to cut it back down to an hour.
Right.
But I think we did a pretty good job of highlighting the structure of how bargaining works and hitting some of the commonly asked questions and misconceptions and addressing that. And of course, like we both said, there's so much we can talk about with bargaining. I'm sure we'll meet again soon and go over more things in depth. If you have any ideas about anything, call me. But to our listeners, if you guys have any questions or concerns, you can always go to ufcw3000.org. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, and everyone have a fabulous day.